Stop the presses, press all the stops, hold the phone, fold the hold, and bring the poop to the poop deck, by heck. Wake the kids and start kidding at the wake, Jake, 'cause there's breaking news about to break. News so good it's hard to take. I got news about blues for all of yous, about which we will all enthuse. For the first time in its history, Lentils and JDMan, Spider on the Web number 29 is going to bring you a musical world premiere of the brand new CD out of Massachusetts by New Bedford's notorious Blues Train Band, evocatively titled Blues Train Band. The launch party for the CD takes place tomorrow, that's Saturday, February 9th, 2008, at the New Bedford Whaling Museum on, God, I love this address, Johnny Cake Hill. Crank up the volume. Here now are my youngest sister-in-law, Dori Leger, on lead vocal, her guitar warlock husband, Don Leger, and Blues Train Band. I predict that before long they'll all be bound to your heart.
You don't have to try to hold me with promises of ecstasy. Just 'cause I'm leaving don't mean that I'm gone. Even if I fly away, you know I'll be back to stay. 'Cause an empty house just ain't no and you don't.
That's a wailing band from a wailing town. New Bedford, Massachusetts' Blues Train Band with a little blues bondage bound to your heart. Several casts ago, I played you some amateur home recordings of Dory and Don jamming with our sister Kathy Rubico, who currently conducts Dionne Warwick's orchestra. I'm very happy to finally be able to play you a few professional quality recordings of Dory and Don. Their longtime accomplices in Blues Train Band are Jack Jennings on vocals, blues harp, and guitars, Jerry DuPont on bass and vocals, and Paul Raymond on vocals and drums. Here, I have another hit of another Dory Leger original featuring some smoking lead guitar by her husband Don. Can I ask you something?
Can you tell me, please, do you still remember those things about me? Those things about me made you scream, follow you at night into your dreams. Can you tell me, please, when you wake each morning, do you think about me? Do you think about me, what I like to do to you? Oh, honey, don't you lie, 'cause I know.
Blues Train Band with Can I Ask You Something? And can I tell you something? I wish I owned a piece of that band. You can learn more about them and see plenty of pictures and stuff at www.bluestrainband.com. And if you're anywhere near New Bedford, Mass. On Saturday the 9th, you can catch them live at their official CD launch, beginning with a reception and open bar at 6 and free performance at 7 at the Whaling Museum, followed by an after-hours party at the Water Street Cafe. I surely wish I wasn't on the other ass end of the continent myself. Okay, time for some sinus friction. A little reading. You know how when some idiot floats a rumor on the internet, it thereby stops being just an idiot rumor and somehow becomes news that's as legitimate to comment on as if it were fact? Well, in much the same way, if somebody else starts bragging on you in public, it becomes okay to talk about it yourself, as if it were not blatantly self-serving. Really. Last week, I was startled, pleasantly for once, to find in my mail a handsome and impressive gilt-bordered scroll identifying me as the winner of Audiophile Magazine's Earphones Award for Excellence for my reading of Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson on Blackstone Audiobooks. Also in the package was a copy of the current issue of Audiophile, in which its SF reviewer reports, and I quote, "Variable Star is a novel that was outlined by the late Robert A. Heinlein in the early phase of his career. Spider Robinson, who offers full details in the afterword, used that outline to create this novel, which reads in equal parts like the works of both authors. Robinson narrates as well, and a better choice couldn't be made. He's got a pleasant, inviting tone that makes his narration feel like a friend telling you the most incredible story about where he's been the last few years. The novel is full of philosophical insight, exploding things, and space travel. It's everything you could ask for from an old and dear friend. Spider Robinson is a top-notch narrator, and this audiobook is a whole lot of fun." Unquote. Thank you very kindly, editor-publisher Robin F. Witten and reviewer SDD of Audiophile Magazine. If there are more gratifying words to read, I don't know what they would be. But this next bunch I'm going to read are pretty gratifying themselves. One last excerpt from Variable Star. I have already given you the first 8 chapters in a row in the earliest Spider on the Web podcasts, which you should find archived at the iTunes store and can definitely find at my website, www.spiderrobinson.com. Maybe you feel that's enough. But this is the chunk of the story I usually use for public readings in libraries or at literary affairs like last year's National Book Festival, for civilians, people who probably don't know anything else about the book or about me or even about Robert Heinlein. And remind me sometime to talk about what it's like dining in the Thomas Jefferson Building with President and Mrs. Bush, Vice President Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Elmo from Sesame Street. If I've only got a half hour or so to try and get across to a stranger what Variable Star is like, this is what I usually give them. Chapter 14. 14. If you don't live it, it won't come out your horn. Bird. Things gradually settled, as they always seem to do eventually, into a routine. At what seemed the approximate speed of mold forming on a corridor wall, life aboard the RSS Charles Sheffield began to take on discernible shape, and then flavor, and finally texture. 500 people slowly got to know one another, heard the first version of each other's backstories and dreams, learned each other's strengths and weaknesses, discovered what we needed and what we had to give, slowly began to design and assemble by trial and error and what few lessons history had made clear enough, a society that would use all of us and feed all of us and give us all something to be part of for 20 uninterrupted years. Complicating the task, of course, the society was intended to become something utterly different at the end of that 20 years and needed to be kept aimed in that direction at all times. For most humans, anything farther ahead than this time next year is the far future. It can be all too easy to lose sight of a goal that far off, and we had to be ready when we got there. The good news was that Meryl Grossman was our coordinator. She had a keen mind, a great understanding of her job, and a way of bullying people that was so transparently an act of love, everyone let her get away with it. 6 months into the voyage, she organized and chaired the Sheffield's first town meeting. It had to be electronic, naturally. Any cubic large enough to have held all of us at once, even in free fall, would have been a preposterous waste of space in a ship that never seemed to have enough. Even the pool could barely have accommodated half of us, and only on the friendliest of terms. But a well-run ETM works better than a live rally in the park, and Coordinator Grossman knew how. I mean, speeches were made, inevitably. We are talking about humans here. But they were kept short, and they assayed out remarkably low in bullshit content. Captain James Bean, a man who looked exactly like you want the captain of your starship to look, and had the reputation to back it up, got 5 minutes and used three. The whole ship rocked with applause when he was done. He was well-liked. 5 minute gab slots also were awarded to Colony Governor Jamie Roberts and to George R., representing the Relativists. Another would have gone to Governor General Lawrence Cott, representative of Kang DaCosta, but he was ill, so his slot was given by his life mate Perry Jarnell, who took 6 minutes. At that point, his audio and video both cut out. After that, even the most pompous speakers quickly figured out that if they hadn't gotten it said within 5 minutes, Merrill wasn't going to let them keep trying. By the time everyone's screens went dark that night, we had accomplished what I considered an astonishing amount. Names, for one thing. People had been arguing them for months, occasionally at a volume that drew proctors. But somehow our coordinator cut through the confusion in a way that didn't seem to leave anyone feeling disenfranchised. And before too long, we had all finally reached consensus on names for most of the places and things that would really matter to all of us when we got to Bravo. I, for one, found most of the choices cheering, too. Our colony seemed to be a jolly crew. The three major continents, for example, were christened Samba, Cheveja, and Carnival. What lay ahead, we knew not, but we intended to have a good time there if we could. At the same time, once he'd explained it to everyone, Matty James's suggested name for our first settlement, Saudade, passed by a landslide with fewer than a dozen opposed, the closest to unanimity we came that night. We all understood that our good times would always, always be seasoned with a sharp regret, a longing for all the lost loved ones and planets and habitats we had left so far behind us forever. To pretend otherwise would be foolish. Nearly as popular a choice were the new names given to our two moons. Nobody had liked the unimaginative names Amiga had given them, New Deimos and New Phobos. For one thing, they didn't look like their namesakes and would not behave like them in the sky. For another, a lot of us were from Mars and did not want our good times tinged with nostalgic regret every single damn time we looked at or discussed the night sky. That was one reason the two closest alternatives to Saudade, Rio de Janeiro and Niterói, had found so few supporters, I think. So I'd been expecting the grassroots effort to rename the moons. But the names chosen were a pleasant surprise from the music of the 20th century. Tom and João. The great composer Antonio Carlos Jobim, known as Tom, and his great disciple João Gilberto, between them created samba, the lush basis of all subsequent Brazilian music, which became a major influence on the work of my favorite saxophonist of that period, Stan Getz. I took that as a good omen and made a mental note to find out if Kathy knew his work with Tom and João. She did, and knew a guitarist who could play Gilberto style. We killed him at the Horn of Plenty all that week. Governor General Cott's partner had by that point leaned on somebody hard enough to get hooked back online and expressed his co-husband's strong distaste on behalf of our noble patrons at Kang DaCosta for the growing tendency of some colonists to shorten the name of our new home to be from Brasil Novo to Bravo. His partner found it disrespectful, and Jarnell found it vulgar, if I've sorted them out correctly. He stopped short of demanding prohibition of the name Bravo, but asked for a resolution agreeing that the proper name was Brasil Novo. The Brazilian support registered strong support. Merrill sighed and asked if anyone else wanted to address the question. A colonist named Robin Feeney spoke up, pointing out that Bravo was a word used to applaud a feat of great difficulty, and a jump of 85 light years certainly qualified. Our successful arrival would itself be a bravo to Captain Bean and his excellent crew. That went over well. The word was also, she added, one we commonly applied to artistic effort that moved us, and as an actress and painter, she hoped hearing it often might help to remind us that the arts would have an important place even in a frontier society. Someone promptly said, "Bravo!" and was widely echoed around the ship. Merrill squelched further debate, put it to a vote, and that was the end of the Cott resolution. Many of us would continue to say Brasil Novo most of the time because, let's face it, it was more elegant. But when we did, it was our choice. More time was nearly wasted on the contentious question of just where on exactly which continent Saudade should be founded. It was a big planet. Almost none of us had an opinion, but the few who did were married to them. Fortunately, before it got out of hand, Merrill pointed out to us that the reason most of us had no opinion was that none of us was entitled to one. It was not yet possible to state with certainty where the best site for a colony might be. We simply didn't know enough yet. Robot probes were good, but they weren't that good. We would simply have to wait until we approached the Peekaboo system and could take a closer look for ourselves. We did more than just pick names that night. Some sensible suggestions were made. Survivor Gerald Knave, for example, proposed we establish a prize of some kind for most constructive complaint of the month. Saul Short broke in to suggest we establish some sort of penalty for the least constructive, but Merrill ruled him out of order and made it stick. The most popular speaker of the evening was clearly the Zog. He spoke on what it was now believed our new home would be like, the local conditions we expected to find, some of the flora and fauna we knew about. Not in any great detail, really, just enough to give a sense of the place. More than a few of us were still as ill-informed as I had once been, and all were spellbound by his descriptions. He made it sound exciting, enticing, mysterious. A steamy jungle planet, shrouded in mists, teeming with life as exotic as if it had been made up to entertain the child at bedtime. His description of the hoop snakes, which bit their own tails, curled up into the shape of a wheel, and then by deforming their belly muscles were able to roll along the trails carved through the jungle by the snipper beasts, had everyone chuckling. Then his straight-faced explication of the propulsive method used by the rocket slugs caused such a ship-wide convulsion of laughter, Merrill had a hard time restoring order. For months thereafter, the words green mist had the power to make us all crack up. I remember thinking at the time that it was the first time the entire colony had laughed together about something, and that I hoped it wouldn't be the last. Zog even managed, don't ask me how, to make the ever-present mortal danger of fire we would face, and even the threat of hungry ghosts, seem like only bedtime story monsters, thrilling but not truly terrifying. I think if you took a poll, most people would agree with me that Bravo Colony's history as a real rather than merely potential entity begins with the moment Kamal Zogby began to speak that night. Before that, we were a big can full of smelly strangers. When he was done, we knew that we were a family, and one that was going to create an entire world from scratch together one day, in an environment strikingly like the one in which humans had first evolved back on Terra, and that it was going to be an adventure. Everything we did would be legend for 10,000 years, the first legends of our planet. There were a couple of obligatory anticlimax speeches and announcements, and then Merrill closed the meeting precisely when she had said she was going to, at 2300 Sheffield time. Ship's time, that is. By that point in our voyage, 6 months out, we were already beginning to use Dr. Einstein's clock instead of Sol. Lorentz contraction had set in, and we were aging just measurably slower than the people we had left behind. How much slower? Not a lot. Yet. At the instant when those of us in the Sheffield passed the 6 month mark of the trip, residents of the solar system were only about 17.5 hours older than we were. But it would get steadily worse as our velocity mounted up, and constant boost mounts up fast. At the 1 year mark, the differential would be about 7 days and 7 hours. At 2 years, it would be more than 58 days. By the 5 year mark, the divergence of our clocks and mankind's would surge up to almost 3 years. We would be traveling at more than 0.938C. And when I had been traveling for 10 years and was 28 years old, more than 45 years would have elapsed on Terra. Behind me, Ginny would be closing in on 64 and receding at 99.794% of the speed of light. Then we would flip over and do the whole thing in reverse, and assuming we got it right and made orbit around Brasil Novo as planned, we peekaboobs would be 20 years older, and Solarians would be something like 85 years older. Ginny would be 103, and probably wouldn't look a day over 80. Time has always struck me as one of the allegedly intelligent designer's ideas that was never properly beta-tested before its implementation. I know, they say it serves to keep everything from happening at once. But what would be so bad about that? You'd get to see both the Big Bang, if there really was one, and the heat death, if there's going to be one. Either way, at either end, you'd know. That and everything else knowable. You'd have what Adam and Eve got cheated out of, what they thought they were bargaining for. Gnosis. So would everybody. No more bullshit.
Okay, so it would lack suspense. But it wouldn't lack surprise. Everything would be a total surprise, always. I have a great career ahead as a consultant in the thriving field of universe design, Saul once told me. I told him he should hire me. Some experts said he and his fellow relativists generated mini-universes like soap bubbles every working day. He said the moment he got a complaint from one of them, I was the guy he would hire to do the renovation. I don't care what Dr. Einstein says. My own clock seemed to speed up as the days went by. Those first few hours after leaving orbit took forever to pass. The first few days went by at a glacial pace. Then, for weeks, every minute of every day brought new information, new people, new situations, new problems, new mistakes, new things to learn and unlearn. After a few months, of course, it began to slack off. At 6 months, I had a fair idea of where to find most of the good stuff and how to avoid most of the bad stuff, and the days started to slide by while I wasn't paying close attention, and events began to sort of lurch forward in quanta rather than unfold in a smooth flow. Things did move forward, though. By the end of the first year, I was on my sixth girlfriend of the voyage. I've already mentioned the first one, twice, but you probably didn't notice her go by. Robin Feeney was the female lead in the Doc Simon play I took Kathy to see on our first and last date, the actress whose performance I was championing just before everything went to hell. When Robin spoke up at that first town meeting, in support of the shorthand name Bravo, I was just out of frame beside her, holding her hand and smiling encouragingly. I'm the one who said, "Bravo!" first when she was done. It got me soundly kissed about 2 minutes after the meeting ended. And that, I'm sorry to admit, is very damn nearly all there is to say about that relationship. That kiss may have been the high point. If my life were a play, Robin would have had to be a pivotal character, vivid and vibrant, the source of several life-changing insights, and utterer of at least one or two lines that would come back to haunt me in the third act. It was a role she was perfectly cast for, too, one she could play the hell out of. Unfortunately, she had no one to write it for her, and no skill at improv. On stage, she was vivid and vibrant. Off stage, she was usually thinking about how to be thought vivid and vibrant the next time she was on stage. I sound like I'm implying that she was more self-centered than I, which is both unfair and untrue. In all honesty, Robin's principal attraction for me was that she was a female mammal with a body temperature of 37 degrees who was willing to share my company in a social context. I certainly didn't think of it in those terms then, of course, but looking back on it, I can see the most powerful emotion I felt throughout was probably relief at finally being able to get Dr. Amy off my case. We couldn't even manage a meet-cute. She came up to me after a set at the Horn to ask the name of the piece Kathy and I had just played. Shaping the Curve, it was, a soprano-piano duet by a 21st-century composer named Colin McDonald. I said if she gave me her address, I would mail her McDonald's own recording, and I did, and after a couple of days of increasingly chatty mail, we finally made a date. That was all there was to it. Herb says a relationship that begins without a good anecdote has no future. He may be right. Ginny and I met online at the campus bookstore the first week of class. She asked if I had a battery wafer she could borrow, and I did. Yawn. And look how that turned out. For our first date, Robin and I picked a common choice. We shared SIM. And once there, the simulation we agreed on was again one of the most common options, background sharing. I showed her typical scenes of life on Ganymede, some of the places and activities that had once mattered to me. She walked me through comparable scenes of life in The Wheel, one of the smaller O'Neills where she had been born. In my opinion, it's also one of the goofier ones, an odd combination of mystical and uptight. They believe in the anthropic principle and live communally and take entheogens, but nobody ever leaves a surface unpolished or an item out of place. I didn't express this opinion, and in return Robin was far too polite to tell me that Ganymede struck her as materialistic and sloppy. Our truth level never did improve much. I did notice that she was a different person when we were in the simulated wheel, one I think I maybe would have liked better. But she didn't. If I want to, or need to, I can reach back into my mental file storage and pull out long stretches of footage representing just about all the major periods and significant people of my life, usually in ultra-definition video with super-saturated color and full-spectrum audio with enhanced treble and bass. In the drawers marked Dad and Ginny, there are extended sequences in true 3D, complete with textured smells and sometimes even tastes. Sadly, such mental files are like analog recordings rather than digital, in that they decay slightly with each playback. At the same time, paradoxically, some of the earliest memories are the most detailed and evocative. But when I try and retrieve memorable scenes from my relationship with Robin, what I get is a series of disjointed, dim, still images, like old photographs, that occasionally animate for a few seconds, with snippets of soundtrack that often fail to match the action. There don't seem to be any inconsequential relationships in drama. I guess they don't have the time. We had plenty of time. If we'd been a play ourselves, and unsubsidized, we'd have closed in a week. As it was, we managed to keep the house lit for months by giving away comp tickets to each other and pretending not to notice the canned applause. But the reviews were never worth clipping. The upside, of course, is that in the end we were able to disengage without doing any important damage to one another. We carried on as though we had, of course, for the drama that was in it, but we gave it up soon and with secret relief on both sides. On mine, anyway. About a week later, as I was wandering around in a daze, thinking, well, I wasn't as horrible as it could have been, I had a meet-cute with Diane Levy. She did not notice me sit down next to her at dinner, tried to turn around and grab the sugar from the table behind us, and cold-cocked me with her elbow. Or was it, I thought, and woke to find her large liquid eyes as close as one might expect to find those of a lover. 4 hours later, she was one. To my complete astonishment, I had made her a thankfully unnoticed gift of my virginity. I lay beside her, gasping for air and grateful for the excuse. What would I say to her now? My brain settled on something or other just as my lungs returned to active duty. I opened my eyes and opened my mouth and discovered Diane was not at all interested in any of those organs. A while later, floating on a rich post-coital sea of relief and pride and satisfaction and regret, I found the perfect words with which to let her down easy. I would simply explain, tell my story truthfully, help her see that I was damaged goods, too scarred by a tragic love to ever love again. If she then chose to take up the to pursue a relationship, my conscience would be clear. Somebody said the great component of semen is draining brain cells. It may well be so. No sense dragging it out, I opened my eyes to begin her disappointment as gently as I could and found myself alone. For the next 3 days, my calls reached only voicemail. My text messages went unanswered. The Sheffield resolutely refused to supply me with any useful data, not location of quarters, usual whereabouts, names of friends, or biographical information. The third time I tried to wheedle it, the ship threatened to rat me out to Dr. Amy if I asked again. By that point, I knew the truth. This was love. The real thing. Not the pathetic charade Ginny and I had mugged our way through, but the love of the ages, the true mystical union of two souls. I knew things about Diane that she didn't know herself, and she was going to explain me to myself, and I was absolutely certain that if she would only give me 13 words, I could make her see it all as clearly as I did. I had it down to 13 words, so good I felt they'd have done the job even as flat-screen text, and I couldn't get a single one of them before her eyes. The first night I just moaned a lot. The second, I raged and wept and made myself a stinking nuisance to my roommates. Balvovats finally took it on himself to drink me under the table and laid me out on my bunk. The third night I went to the Horn and laid a drunken monologue on Kathy that would damage our friendship for months to come. At the time, she limited her remarks to a polite hope that things would work out well for me and a slap with so much wrist to it that a proctor was halfway to the table before I could wave him off. Tossing in my comfortable bunk that night, I got it down to 6 words. I'd need eye contact, but if I could just get 6 lousy words in... The next morning, while I was in the fresher, paying an ugly coin for 2 nights' debauchery, Diane phoned. Diane, let me call you back. Joel, dear, I appreciate your interest. I had a wonderful time with you. Perhaps I will again one day, but it can't be soon. It's just simple math, dear. I don't understand. Look, Ken, I have to make a big decision sometime in the next 20 years. It's going to affect my whole life. Obviously, my information has to be as complete as possible. Even after I rule out seniors, mono-gays, and other permanent ineligibles, there are something over 200 possible mates in the world. I like to keep my weekends for reading, so that means I'll work my way back around to you again in a little over 40 weeks, not even a year. I stared at my wrist and reminded myself that my guts had been churning before the phone had rung.
"Are you telling me you've already—"
"Yes, dear, but I assure you I remember you with particular fondness." Spasm.
"One day isn't long enough to—"
"I find that by the second or third day one forms attachments, don't you? At that rate, I could easily take the whole voyage identifying the right husband. I'd still be breaking him in when we hit dirt at Bravo. You understand, I'm sure. Or rather, I hope. If so, I'll see you in 40 weeks, give or take. Unless I get lucky and lightning strikes, of course." She hung up before I could wail her name. It didn't stop me. Let's just say the next 5 or 10 minutes stressed that fresher to its design limits and beyond, and leave it at that. So I sought a mojo. That's a term from pre-collapse times. It means a love charm, a magic spell or fetish of some kind that I could use to make Diane see her search was over. Naturally, I sought the advice of an expert. Maddie James listened sympathetically to my tale of woe, nodding in all the right places. Until I named my beloved, then his face went blank and he sat back in his chair and shook his head.
"Son, I'm afraid I am powerless to help you."
"Huh? What do you mean? Why?"
"Diane made love to me once."
He sighed.
"I spent 2 hours down on the ag deck eating dirt before I resumed my human shape."
His left foot was tapping uncontrollably on the deck.
"My advice is to be thankful you weren't 200th on our list, and quit trying to hog a natural resource."
From there, my love life went downhill. Eventually, I gave it up as a failed experiment and put my mind on my work. Let's see. There was Barbara Manning, a student of Dr. Amy's, her suggestion, and then an engineer named Mariko Stoppel, Tiger's suggestion, followed by a physics student named Darren Mader, who had the superstitious notion that perhaps something of my father's innate genius might be exuded in my sweat or something, followed closely by his former girlfriend when I proved a dry hole. Both of those his idea. And then, if I have the sequence correct, there were... Can I stop now? This emotional striptease not only embarrasses me, it's boring. Everyone's early love life is boring, sometimes even to the protagonists at the time. Let it stand that eventually the awkwardness started to wear off, and when the dust settled, I found myself a normal, healthy, het-bi bachelor with somewhat less than average interest in casual sex and even less interest in emotional commitment. Well, that described a lot of us in the Sheffield. There was no rush in forming a partnership that had nothing much to do for another couple of decades. Unless, of course, you decided you wanted to arrive at Bravo with children tall enough to be useful, which an unsurprising number of colonists did. But a nearly equal number concluded, as I did, that a ball of mud, even alien mud, had to be a better place to raise children than a metal can. And the last 5 or 6 years of the voyage, when things were just starting to gear up to their busiest, would be a poor time to be ass-deep in bored, surly, invincibly ignorant teenagers, such as I was now. Sol Short once told me, mankind is divided into two basic sorts. Those who find the unknown future threatening, and those who find it thrilling. He says the rupture between those two sides has been responsible for most of the bloodshed in history. If change threatens you, you become conservative in self-defense. If it thrills you, you become liberal in self-liberation. He says the threatens are frequently more successful in the short run because they always fight dirty. But in the long run, they always lose because thrilled people learn and thus accomplish more. I don't know. In those days, I would have to say my basic orientation was toward the threatened school. I had begun life by losing a mother I never knew, except as a source of rhythmic thumping sounds and intermittent gurgling noises and comforting warmth. Then, when I was just old enough to get the full impact, I found out how infinitely much worse it is to lose a parent you know. My world had just begun to shake with the changes of puberty when it exploded in my face. At the moment I most needed adult guidance, my supply of parents dwindled to zero. Then for a while, everything had been change, and almost all of it had been unpleasant. I had not until then fully realized that I was odd, that there was anything strange about growing up with a single-parent genius. I thought all homes had equations scrawled with disc marker across all the cabinets and walls, and clean laundry in the freezer, and defrosting chicken in the tool drawer. I thought everyone read a book a day and listened to hours of ancient music. My father raised no wimps. I'd buckled down and got to work, examined my options, made a plan, made it work, started at last to acquire the confidence that I could get a handle on this life business just like everybody else, and then I'd met Ginny. So maybe you can understand that my instinctive tendency in those early years of the voyage was to tuck my chin down into my chest, hunch my shoulders, cover up with both forearms, and keep backpedaling. The temporary insanity with Diane was my last flirtation with grand passion and romance. After that, I was more in the market for companionship, intellectual stimulation, perhaps a little cautious friendly sex every now and again, perhaps not. I really did comprehend, intellectually at least, that I was engaged in one of the most profoundly thrilling endeavors in human history. How conservative can you be if you've jumped off the edge of the solar system? Do conservative people travel at relativistic speeds? By the end of the first year of our voyage, we were already traveling at more than a third of the speed of light, and even though there were no sensory cues at all to confirm that, we were all well aware of it and believed it, and I think I can safely say we all found it more than a little thrilling. By the time we reached turnover in 9 more years, our velocity was going to peak at a hair-frying 0.99794C. Does a conservative man race photons? It wasn't that I couldn't see the future was going to be thrilling. It wasn't that I was unwilling or even reluctant to be thrilled. I just had little experience with it. The mores and customs we had all been raised in, fruits of the covenant, continued to work their unlikely magic. Even in close and closed quarters, we found ways to live together without violence, to a large extent without malice, and with as much kindness as we could find within ourselves. At the end of that first year, we celebrated with a party that would become so legendary I don't think I'll discuss it here. There are several detailed accounts available, and I disagree with every one of them on some of the details. One point on which there is agreement, however, is that there were no quarrels. No relationships broke up. No feuds were born. If anyone had a really bad time, they managed to conceal it from one of the best gossip networks in history. I'm not saying there were no unhappy people aboard. A predictable percentage of us concluded, much too late, that they'd made a terrible mistake in joining the colony. A predictable few of those became merchants of gloom, prophets of doom, carriers of that most infectious of diseases, fear. And a few just became so profoundly miserable they lowered morale wherever they passed. Dr. Amy and her 3 colleagues had their work cut out for them. It made me want to stop being a jerk faster to free up her time. So I worked at it. By the end of the first year of that voyage, I had at least a working 2-part answer to the question, who is Joel Johnston? First, I was a guy who was going to sing to the stars. I would sing with my horn and with all the other instruments of man to a star whose very existence had been unsuspected for most of history. I would sing of human beings, since words would not do, to a star system that knew nothing of them or anything like them. I would sing of my fellow colonists in what I hoped was a universal language to a planet we hoped would see fit to nurture and sustain us all. And I would sing of myself and perhaps another to 2 strange new moons in the night sky and slightly distorted constellations. Second, I was a guy who was going to talk to strange dirt. On the long voyage, I would speak softly to alien soil, in my best approximation of its own language, asking it as politely as I could to accept Terran plants that would feed my colony. I would open negotiations with the ecosystem of Bravo and listen intently to the responses that came back. Zog and I and all the rest of his crew would spend the years staring until our eyes watered at the probe's surface recon images of Brasil Novo's surface, trying to outguess the planet, speculating endlessly over what sorts of new predators, parasites, or other perils were most likely to exist, arguing endlessly over what we might do about them. It's difficult to plan for the unknown. All right, it's impossible. But we were going to do our level best. It was a place to stand. Sing to new stars, speak to new dirt. 2 planted legs to help keep me upright for the next couple of decades. First we love music, then we love food. Many years later, we evolve high enough to love another. If we're lucky.
Props on that earphones award, by the way, to Mr. Rob Bailey, the owner, engineer, mixer, and fixer of the Treehouse Studio on Bowen Island, British Columbia, where Variable Star and all my Blackstone audiobooks were recorded. Check them out at the-treehouse-studio.com. Rob has a modern state-of-the-art Mac-based 5.1 studio, can not only record your next CD, he's got the facilities to put up your entire band and their spouses and their lovers within walking distance of the studio. Check him out. I ought to explain that last paragraph just a bit. Turns out modern medicine has now gotten so good we can save babies that were born so premature they actually lack the sucking reflex. They're literally too dumb to eat. Fortunately, these little fellers can be trained to suck with classic reward techniques. But now, the obvious question is, how do you reward something too primitive to eat? With music. And not just rhythm, either. The little tykes will do whatever it takes to hear a favorite scrap of melody repeated. Got that? The desire to hear music is more deeply hardwired in you than the desire to eat. That explains a lot about my life, and to me at least, and that begins to explain the power of the next track featuring lead vocals by Blues Train Band singer-guitarist Harmonic Cat Jack Jennings, and his subject happens to be the same thing Joel was just musing about. Time.
Elma James works so hard, never did rest on his farm. Precious commodity is finding free time. Daughter Angelina waits on tables not too far. Goes to school at night, hopes to pass by. She never has any free time. The bills. When he has a free moment, he's got errands to fill. Can't do his art, 'cause he doesn't have the time. Time to spend with yourself. Time to see a friend or be a friend. No.
time.
All right, I'm going to play you out with one more Blues Train Band cut, but I just found this ancient demo tape in a vault, and it's just over 2 minutes long, and despite its flaws, I simply can't resist sharing it. This is Dory Leger and her big sister Kathy, the first woman accompanist ever to play on Johnny Carson, with Annie Ross's brilliant lyric for a Wardell Gray sax solo, named after me, Twisted.
Told me that I was right out of my head the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not. No, no, no.
Mindless told me
that I was right out of my head. He said I need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined
when out of his sight to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts.
No more ifs or ands or buts. Well, they say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas. I knew what was up, I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. Oh yeah. And I heard a little chapel was supposed to sleep tight. Well, that's why I got into the reef for one night. My parents got frantic, they didn't know what to do. And I saw some crazy things before I came to know. Do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They laughed at angry young men. They laughed at Edison and also at Einstein. So I should have been sorry if I just couldn't understand the idiomatic logic that went on in my head. And it faded from the top. No, do it. Two heads are better than one.
I apologize to Dory, to Kathy Rubico, and to you for the bungled tape splice halfway through. My fault, but I just love that track. In addition to her blues muse, Dory has a jazz vocal degree, and I'm hoping the jazz CD she and Don have been threatening will be available soon. Right now, I'm dedicating my last selection from Blues Train Band to the Leger's daughter, Jenna, who has a sweet voice herself, and son Ian, a drummer and cellist. For Ian and Jenna, son and daughter, here's Drink the Water, and I thank you, water.
Said, mm-hmm. Oh, no drugs I can take. There's no magic potion, no other choice I can make. Lost under your power, lost under your spell. I gotta find something, something to make me well. So I went to my mother. I said, Mama, can you help me? Well, first she cried and then she sighed. She said, girl, what are you doing to me? You gotta drink the water.
Drink the water.
Go ahead and drink the water.
Drink the water.
Oh, baby, drink the water.
Drink the water.
I'm gonna tell you about it one more time. You got to drink, drink the water.
Find out more about Dory, Don, Jack, Jerry, and Paul, go to www.bluestrainband.com. As always, this episode of Spider on the Web is being podcast under Creative Commons license. No derivatives, non-commercial, share-alike copyright material is covered. Your donations and or subscriptions are greatly appreciated at spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html. Now let's both go try and make somebody smile. Or even giggle.